From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Earlier this month, we began a series of conversations getting at the nature of God. Whatever God you believe in, how do you explain suffering and tragedy in light of that belief? Well, for Richard Dawkins, the premise of the question is flawed. Dawkins is a distinguished evolutionary biologist who doesn't believe in God, much less in an ordered universe. But he takes issue with the idea that non-believers have a cold or bleak reaction to tragedies like the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Dawkins says you shouldn't confuse skepticism with a lack of warmth or ambition or concern. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about an atheist's perspective on suffering and tragedy. Dawkins says we're on our own in this universe. So instead of looking for a God to question or blame, we should look to science or ourselves. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In one of his books, Challenging the Existence of a God, Richard Dawkins says he sometimes asks how he can bear to get up in the morning. The question is usually based on this assumption that relying just on science to make sense of the world leaves you with a perspective that is somehow cold or bleak, that without a supernatural being guiding the universe, life is empty and purposeless. Well, Dawkins says there isn't a grand purpose to life, but that shouldn't be confused with a loss of personal hope. Today in the program, we continue our series of conversations about how different people explain the nature of God in light of the reality of tragedy. Today in the program, Dawkins is joining us to offer an atheist's perspective. He says we should get up off our knees and face reality, and that's really the only way to properly deal with human suffering. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. Questions or comments, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Richard Dawkins is, of course, an evolutionary biologist and the founder of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. He retired from Oxford University in 2008, where he held a professorship for the public understanding of science. Of course, he's written many books, including The God Delusion, The Greatest Show on Earth, and most recently a children's book called The Magic of Reality. He's joining us today from Colorado, where he's speaking. He's at the studios of NPR member station KRCC in Colorado Springs. And Richard Dawkins, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your admirable summary of my views, which I couldn't have done better myself.
Okay, good. Well, I want to begin with, by giving you the opportunity to kind of challenge the premise of the series. I mean, we got to thinking about all of this in the aftermath of the killings of the elementary school in Connecticut. What do you make, first of all, of this inclination to, you know, examine the nature of God in the aftermath of a tragedy like this?
Well, I don't think that there is a God. I think we're on our own. I think that we are, we have the responsibility to stand up and face the universe the way it is. We're not here for very long. We should make the most of life. When tragedy happens, we need to face up to it. We need to try to think of action that will stop it happening again. So we don't turn to imaginary friends. We don't turn to some spell giver in the sky. We look to our own resources to how to stop something like the school shooting tragedy happening ever again.
Mm. You've written about the various responses you've heard to particular tragedies. You wrote about one response that came from a clergyman who said that he had no intellectual answers. He said an explanation will only be found in a life lived by faith, prayer, contemplation, and Christian action. And you get really annoyed by responses like that.
Well, I think annoyed's putting it a little bit strongly. It doesn't sound to me very constructive. It doesn't sound to me like a recipe for action. It sounds to me more like a recipe for sitting back and kind of hoping that something will turn up.
I wanted to get some perspective. In your book, The God Delusion, you tell the story about a teacher that you really liked at school when you were young. He was this chaplain at your school. And he had, kind of a liberal perspective, it seems like. He didn't force religion down your throat, you say. And you talk about how this man was really enthralled by the natural world, you know, the creatures and the stars above. And you say in that way he was very much like you. But he interpreted all of that sense of wonder, in religious terms. Now, you don't, obviously. And you ask in the book why the same emotion should have led the chaplain in one direction and you in the other. And I wonder if you have a sense of why you think that is.
I began The God Delusion with this story. It's a story of this man when he was a boy. He was lying on his stomach looking into the grass, and suddenly the grass, all the little beetles and bugs and things seemed to swell, and he became one with the universe. I just wanted to make the point that you don't have to be a God-fearing religious person in order to get that feeling. Scientists in general tend to have that sense of awe, tend to have that sense of almost mystical desire for oneness with the universe, looking up at the stars, looking down a microscope, contemplating the complexity of life, the complexity of your own body. It is wonderful, it's amazing, it's exhilarating. Mm. And one of the most exhilarating things about it is that modern science is coming very close to understanding it. We don't have to just lie back and passively say, oh, isn't it marvellous, isn't it wonderful? We say, yes, it's marvellous and wonderful, and even more marvellous and wonderful is that we can understand it. Mm. And if we can't yet understand it, we've got a pretty good recipe for how to understand it in the future, and that's called science.
You say this idea of transcendent wonder has really, over the centuries, been monopolized by religion.
Yes, I think it has been monopolized by religion, and I think it's about time that science wrested it from religion's control. The books by Carl Sagan, for example, the books by Isaac Asimov, I'd like to think the books by me, do indeed attempt to convey that sense of wonder, and in a purely scientific way.
I want to get you make this defense of the sort of atheist perspective in a lot of your books, and this idea that, as I said in the introduction, that somehow there's this impression that if you don't believe in a God, that life has no purpose and that it's cold and empty. And you quote a pretty severe – this was something that your colleague Peter Atkins had written. This was years ago. This was in the 1980s, I think, in his book The Second Law. And he writes this. You quote him in your book, in one of your books. He says that the children that he explains that humans are the children of chaos. At root, there is only corruption. Gone, he says, is purpose. This is the bleakness that we have to accept as we peer into the heart of the universe. And I guess there's some sense that you worry that that's giving us a sense that, again, we're that somehow if you have an atheist perspective, you have no sense of personal hope, or you have no broader sense of meaning.
You make your own sense of hope. You make your own meaning. We as individuals can make our own meaning, and I do, and I'm sure Peter Atkins does too. In that particular passage from Peter Atkins, he was talking about the second law of thermodynamics and how, as a chemist, he sees the whole of the universe being driven by the second law of thermodynamics, which is a drive towards chaos, towards emptiness, towards a final bleak nothingness. That is what drives chemistry. That's what drives biology. That's what drives everything from a purely chemical point of view. But it's a complete misunderstanding to say, therefore, as individual humans, we should feel hopeless and empty and bleak. Of course we shouldn't. We can have desires, we can have ambitions, we can have aims, and we do. And your aim may be to write a book, or it may be to win a football match, or it may be to get married. There are all sorts of worthwhile aims that we can have, which have nothing to do with a chemist's view of the second law of thermodynamics, which can be seen as being driven towards chaos.
How do you explain the impulse to believe in a God? How is it that, you know, you, in the God delusion in particular, you take on this question of why cultures create religion?
Well, this is a very different kind of question. Now, you're asking a question about human psychology, and it's not difficult to imagine why people might wish to invent supernatural beings. We come into the world, we find ourselves bewildered by the world in which we are. We need explanation, and we tend to fall back on the simple explanations that satisfy us with childhood. We tend to think that there must be a designer. We tend to think there must be some kind of spirit, some kind of mind that thought it all out. And we've grown out of that now. Science has grown out of that now. With modern science going on from Darwin's successors, we now understand how it is that a completely purposeless universe, a purpose-free universe, can give rise to all the beauty, the magnificence, the complexity of life and of the world. We now do understand that. It is beautiful, it is exhilarating, but it's not surprising that psychologically people who are not educated in science do still resort to childish explanations, which turn out to be non-explanations.
Is that a biological impulse, Did we evolve that impulse?
Well, in a sense, I mean, I think what you could say is that brains have evolved, mm-hmm. and brains have evolved psychological tendencies, and among those psychological tendencies are some that do manifest themselves as religion. I mean, I just mentioned the desire for explanation. That's only one of them. Right. There's also things like the desire to obey authority, the desire to believe your parents, the desire to believe what authority figures, what elders of the tribe tell you. That's another recipe for religion, or I should rather say another recipe for what will manifest itself as religion under the right conditions.
Are you at all surprised when you hear believers defending God and their belief in God in the aftermath of tragedies? I mean, you've written that you had this kind of naive sense that believers might be feeling more inclined to curse their God than to pray to him when something really terrible
yes.
happens.
I mean, this is one of the things that theologians most worry about, the problem of theodicy, the problem of, you know, where was God in the earthquake, where was God in the tsunami, and so on. I mean, that is a problem for people who believe in God. And so when terrible tragedies happen, it is not surprising that those who wish to cling to their God come up with defensive explanations for why God allowed it to happen. I, of course, have no need for those defensive explanations because I don't think there is a God. But if you're thoroughly wedded to your God, the idea of there being a God, then when a terrible tragedy happens, you do feel the need to defend him. And you get really quite absurd things like when hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in some awful tragedy, and then one child is saved with only a broken leg or something, and you say, thank God that child was saved. I mean, it's just something rather ironic about that.
You've talked about the problem of evil, you know, for some is a really good argument against the existence of a God, but you've never found that, you say, to be terribly persuasive, because why assume that your God will be good?
Yes, that's right. I mean, as I said, theologians worry about the problem of evil, and that's most theologians will tell you that their most worrying times are when they contemplate the problem of evil. Mm. I don't really care that much about it because, as I say, if you believe in a God, it could be an evil God. There's no particular reason to think that your God's going to be a good God. So it doesn't really help you one way or the other. I prefer to say that bad things happen because things happen. Earthquakes happen because of plate tectonics. Tsunamis happen because of earthquakes. Fires happen because of the reason fires happen. I mean, these tragedies happen, and the explanation for those tragedies is a scientific explanation. And so there isn't really a problem of evil. Mm. It's just that bad, unfortunate things do happen. And our task as rational human beings is to try to minimize the number of bad things that happen and maximize the effectiveness of our response to them when they do happen.
I want to get to this constructive way of dealing with tragedy, but I want to work through a little bit more about the way you see people working through and react to this, you know, this question of the nature of God. Because you've talked about how the sense of how believers defend a God, because it seems as though you're saying they try and make God so malleable that in many ways they can make God fit really into any kind of scenario. You quote the physicist Steven Weinberg, who talks about how God is so broad that inevitably you can find him wherever you look. You just sort of expand the idea of a God.
Yes, that's right. I mean, if you define God as, I don't know, but that which we don't yet understand, I mean, that's pretty much how Einstein defined God.
Yeah, yeah.
Einstein often used the word God, actually, and he used the word God as an expression, as a metaphor for that which we don't understand. So he said, did God have a choice in creating the universe? What he meant was, is it possible for there to have been more than one kind of universe, or is there only one kind of universe that could exist? Einstein chose to express it using the word God, and many people have wrongly taken that to mean that Einstein was a theist. Einstein yeah. believed in God. He didn't. Einstein was an atheist. Now, people will who define God so broadly as that, as Einstein did, as you quote Steven Weinberg, as Steven Weinberg said, you can find God in a lump of coal mm-hmm. if you define God that broadly. But then, of course, you have to contrast that with the sort of God who turns water into wine, who's born of a virgin, who's crucified and then rises from the dead, who raises Lazarus from the dead, who walks on water. That's a very, very, very much more specific kind of God than the sort of God of the physicists.
Here's how you put it. You've written that if the word God is not to become completely useless, then it should be used in a way that people have generally understood it, which is to say, to denote a supernatural creator. So what you're saying is that believers can't or shouldn't anyway be able to have it both ways? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. They can't have it both ways. I mean, either you believe in a God who works miracles, who answers prayers, who forgives sins, who was crucified and rose from the dead. If you believe in that, then that's what you believe in and you should stand by it. But then another kind of person might believe in the sort of God who isn't really a God at all, the God of Einstein. You cannot have it both ways. You must plump for one or the other. You can't use an Einsteinian argument for the existence of some kind of inexplicable spirit behind the universe, something like that. Even that's not Einsteinian. But if you do that, then you cannot get away with saying, oh, therefore, Jesus is my Lord and Savior. Jesus was born of a virgin, walked on water. The things do not follow. One is far, far more specific than the other. Or Muhammad split the moon in two or whatever and flew to the heaven on a winged horse. Because all the religions have these miracle stories. It's a totally different kind of animal you're talking about. Use the word religion for one or the other. Don't confuse us by using it for both.
It seems like you almost have, and I don't want to use too strong a word, so I'll back off on this word, but it seems like there's almost a sense of disdain for the so-called liberal theologian, the so-called sophisticated Christians. Because you've talked about, for example, Pat Robertson, who comes right out and says, tragedy is the result of sin. And you say that at least he doesn't, Robertson, however abhorrent what he's saying may be, at least he doesn't try and justify it or tie himself up in gymnastics to try to rationalize it. He just comes right out and says it. It seems like you almost have more respect for that kind of honesty than someone wrapping themselves around some justification.
Yeah, I mean, you can put that too strongly. It's true that a real fundamentalist crazy like Pat Robertson, in some ways, you know where he stands, you know what you're arguing with. The liberal theologians, the liberal Christians who don't have any truck with that, who don't believe in creation, who don't believe in Adam and Eve, it's hard to pin down exactly what it is they do believe. I mean, obviously what they do believe is a lot more sensible than what a Pat Robertson or a Ted Haggard or somebody believes. But there is a kind of a sense that at least you know where they stand, you know what you're arguing with. With a liberal theologian, you sometimes get the feeling you're kind of arguing with a wet sponge. I mean, you can't sort of get a grip on it. But I think disdain would be putting it too strongly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do need to, obviously, scientists do need to make common cause with liberal theologians when we're fighting the battle for science education in schools, where, of course, any decent theologian is in favor of the teaching of evolution because it's simply scientifically true, and no respectable theologian denies that. So we do need to make common cause with liberal theologians over that kind of educational issue.
Mm. Has that been a difficult balance to strike? Your skepticism, your sense of confusion is better said about sort of some of these liberal perspectives, and yet they're the ones that you see having, you can ally with in some way.
Well, it's not too bad a problem. I mean, I've several times made alliance with the recent Bishop of Oxford, Richard Harris, for example. Mm-hmm. He got together a group of bishops, I got together a group of scientists, mostly fellows of the Royal Society, to write a joint letter to the Prime Minister of Britain protesting about the teaching of creationism in schools. And so the bishops and the scientists were cooperating on that, and it was a very good cooperation. And it is important that we should do that. But then when we come to argue about things like the existence of God, then of course I'm on the opposite side from those bishops.
Mm-hmm. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Richard Dawkins is with us, the author of many books, including The God Delusion and The Greatest Show on Earth. His latest is a children's book called The Magic of Reality. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our conversation about the nature of God. The idea comes in the aftermath of the murders in Newtown, Connecticut. We've been asking, why would a loving God allow such a tragedy? Well, of course, our guest today challenges the premise of the question that there is a God at all. Richard Dawkins is our guest, the evolutionary biologist and outspoken atheist. He's the author of a number of books, among them The God Delusion, The Greatest Show on Earth. His latest is a children's book called The Magic of Reality. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR member station KRCC in Colorado Springs. He's in Colorado speaking this week. 801-585-WEST is the number to join our conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's an email from Ross, who writes from Salt Lake City. He says, thank you for your books, and he mentions you've advanced his understanding of a lot. He says, it's common for people to feel that their religious beliefs are part of who they are, maybe even their core identity. And Ross writes, does your atheistic worldview feel like part of who you are, or does it feel more like a well-considered conclusion?
I'd like to think it's a well-considered conclusion. I do sympathize with people who identify with their religion and feel it's part of who they are. They've been with it ever since childhood, and it's very hard to give it up. It's very hard to give it up, partly for that reason, and partly because it may involve friction with family. I've heard numerous stories of people being disowned by their parents, by their husband, by their wife, by their children, because they've given up religion, and that's terribly, terribly sad. It shouldn't happen. After all, it's only... all we're talking about is a belief about the cosmos and morality and things like that. It shouldn't be so much a part of your identity that you feel cut off from your childhood, from your roots, and from your family. I suppose everybody, in a sense, has to say that what they think about, what they believe, is a part of their identity. But I think we should be flexible enough to give it up if the evidence warrants giving it up. I would certainly give up my worldview if evidence came along to warrant a change in my worldview, like a shot.
Mm. I wonder, when you hear of tragedies, let's take the Newtown, Connecticut thing, because that sort of is the experience that got us started with all of this. What do you make of it? How do you not understand it? Because it's, you can't understand it, but how do you react to it? Things like that.
I react with great sorrow, with passionate anger that this kind of thing can happen, but I try to make it constructive. I try to think, how could it have been avoided, and how can we avoid it in the future? Mm-hmm. So I say to myself, well, in all countries of the world, there are crazy people. There are lunatics, there are madmen, there are schizophrenics, there are people who, if they got a weapon in their hands, would do terrible things. Might it be just possibly a solution to make weapons harder to get hold of, so that the crazies who do exist in every country are not able to put their craziness into violent action by pulling a trigger? I mean, I may be wrong about that. Maybe there are good arguments in favor of the rather common United States view that everybody should be allowed to have a gun. But at least it's worth thinking about, would that be a possible solution? My point is only that we need to think constructively about what would be a solution to the problem of stopping this kind of thing happening again.
Mm-hmm. You write that suffering is a byproduct of evolution, but just by natural selection. You say it's an inevitable consequence that may worry us in our more sympathetic moments, but you say it cannot be expected to worry a tiger, for example, or a tiger's genes.
No, that's right. I mean, Darwin himself worried about this, and it's the very nature of natural selection, which is the driving force of evolution, that life's going to be pretty unpleasant. I mean, it depends upon competition between individuals within a species, competition to survive, to reproduce, and that means competition to get away from predators, competition to be better than your rivals at catching prey. Pain is irrelevant. If something is painful and horrible and terrifying, then unfortunately natural selection doesn't care about that. And if you sit down and soberly contemplate the amount of suffering that goes on in the world as gazelles and rabbits and rats and antelopes and horses are pursued by predators, and the predators themselves are desperately anxious for a meal, otherwise they'll starve to death. Natural selection will all the time be pushing towards greater and greater suffering. The consequence of this is that beautiful things evolve, and a leopard and a cheetah and an antelope are beautiful, beautiful creatures, and they're beautiful because their ancestors have been naturally selected to run very fast and be very good at doing what they do. But that natural selection process has involved suffering in every single generation. Mm. So it is a rather depressing prospect, but it's reality, and we should face up to reality. Yeah. There's no reason because something is depressing to say that therefore it can't be true. Unfortunately, the truth can be depressing. But we have our life to lead as human beings, and we need to stand up, face life squarely, and make the most of life. And most of us manage to do that pretty well.
Yeah, you write about how Darwin really struggled, as you say, with this concept. And there was a certain type of wasp who had this really difficult behavior, I guess, as he saw it. And he really had a hard time imagining how that fit.
I think you're talking about Darwin's remark about the ichneumon wasps.
Exactly.
There are several kinds of wasps which make their living by catching a grub, a caterpillar or something like that, stinging it, burying it underground, and then laying their eggs in it, and then the larvae hatch out and eat it. Now, it's important for the larvae that the grub that is providing food for them should not be fully dead. It should be paralyzed so that it can't escape. And so what these wasps do is they sting systematically in the ganglia of the nervous system of the caterpillar, let's say, so that the caterpillar is paralyzed, can't move, but nevertheless goes on being alive. So it's a live store of meat for the larvae of the wasp. Now, this is horribly cruel, and Darwin recognized that it's horribly cruel. Darwin actually said, "I find it hard to imagine how a loving God could have created the ichneumonidae," that's the family of wasps that he was talking about. Yeah. But of course, as far as natural selection is concerned, it unfortunately doesn't matter that the caterpillar may be in great pain, being eaten alive from within, while being paralyzed and unable to move. That's the most efficient way for natural selection to work, and that's the way it does work. Too bad. We can't say that because something is unpleasant, therefore it isn't true.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Devin is with us in Salt Lake City. Devin, welcome.
Hi. It's a pleasure and honor to speak with you, Dr. Docking. It's been a great inspiration to me and my family. I was born and raised Mormon, and I went on a mission and sort of came home, and I was always a good Mormon and everything, but the problem of evil really caused me to leave the Mormon church and the suffering of children. But my question was, working now in the computer science field, we'll begin to merge computer science with human consciousness as we learn more about both, and eventually transfer human consciousness, I believe, into a computer simulation, and we can minimize human suffering in many ways. And I just wanted to get your opinion on how this is going to have an impact on people's faith, what it's going to do for the nature of people's subjective reality, and just what your feelings are, sir.
It's a great question.
This is science fiction, futuristic stuff, and it is very, very fascinating, and nobody knows whether what you say is right. It's a very plausible conjecture, and I think it is perfectly plausible that at some time in the future, maybe the quite distant future, human consciousness may merge with machine consciousness, and we don't know whether that'll happen, and there are some philosophers who dispute that, other philosophers who think it will happen. I suspect that neither you nor I will be around to see that happen. I think it's actually quite a long way into the future, but it will be interesting to see how that affects people's religious beliefs, people's psychology. It'll be quite disturbing, I suspect. Your preamble, when you said that you left the Mormon church because of the problem of evil, that's why many people leave whichever church they're brought up in. In the specific case of the Mormon church, I'm actually quite curious as to why, since I know this is going out in Salt Lake City, why more people don't leave the Mormon church out of sheer skepticism of the origins of the Mormon church. I mean, the sheer implausibility of the idea that a man called Smith in the 19th century dug up some golden tablets and read them with the aid of a magic hat. I'm just amazed that people aren't more skeptical, aren't more critical, that they just don't think about the the plausibility of that. Was this man not actually a charlatan?
Well, how do you answer that question? I mean, you've written a bit about credulity and why people believe the things they do. Do you think you have a sense of understanding?
Well, no, I'm actually mystified. In the case of Joseph Smith, he was a 19th century man, yet he chose to translate these tablets into 16th century English. I mean, that's got charlatan written all over it. Why on earth, if you're a 19th century man faced with ancient characters on golden plates, would you not translate it into the language you speak, which was 19th century English? Clearly he was steeped in the King James Bible, and he wanted to make a fake Bible, which is what he did. Why is it that so many Mormons don't see through him? He was an obvious fake.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. I guess to Devin's, Devin had a broader point, I guess. Let's not go so far as to saying computer science is going to, at some great tipping point, figure out human consciousness. Let's just talk about what we're learning about the brain now, what we're understanding about the way the brain works, or the way the, you know, or just technology in general. Is that, do you think, changing our perspective on the way we view, you know, religious issues, issues about God, all those kinds of things?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, the more it becomes apparent that the brain is where it's happening, the brain is where consciousness is. And so the idea that consciousness would somehow survive the death of the brain becomes more and more implausible. The fact that one's entire personality, one's soul, if you like, can change as a result of a brain injury, can change as a result of chemical treatment of the brain, it shows that the brain is, it's a physical object, and somehow a manifestation of that physical object is the human personality, the human consciousness, the human soul. So, yes, I think the more we learn about the brain, the more implausible does it become that there's some kind of disembodied spirit that is apart from the brain and which is capable of surviving the decay of the brain when we die. And there's another point, a similar point, which is evolutionarily, since we know we're descended from ape-like creatures, and we know that ape-like creatures gradually changed into modern chimpanzees, and at the same time, different groups of ape-like creatures changed into humans, mm-hmm. Was there a moment at which the soul was suddenly injected into one particular lineage, as Roman Catholics believe? It just doesn't ring plausible. It doesn't ring true. And if you think about it from a scientific point of view, if you think about the evolution of the brain and the physiology of the brain from a scientific point of view, it doesn't make sense.
Back to the phones. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Nick is with us in Orem, Utah. Nick, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Dawkins, for all of your work. It's very inspirational. I just recently finished The God Delusion literally this morning for the second time, and I am particularly struck with the last section about God being very similar to people's imaginary friends. You talk about the Binker and the Purple Man, and I'm wondering if, in your opinion, the solace that religion brings to people in times of trouble and hardship is almost the most important thing to people about religion. Almost, it doesn't matter that Joseph Smith, it was very plausible for them to, that the way that he translated books and made this made-up religion. The most important thing to people is that it helps them through times of trouble. And I'm wondering if, in your opinion, that's the biggest hurdle people have to giving up gods, and if so, how do you approach it if they're almost willing to hold on to that regardless of anything else?
I think that's a very good point, a very sympathetic point. It is undoubtedly true that many people do get consolation from their religion. To go from that to say that it doesn't even matter whether it's true, what matters is only whether it's consoling. I don't know about you, but I would find it impossible to be consoled by something if I didn't believe it was true. I mean, you could say, supposing I've got an inoperable cancer and the doctor tells me a lie, then no doubt the lie will be consoling to me, but nevertheless it isn't true. I find it, I have a hard time justifying beliefs on the grounds that they're consoling unless they are also true. As a subsidiary point, it's not obvious to me, actually, that religious belief always is consoling. I don't know enough about Mormonism to know this, but in certainly some religions, I think Roman Catholicism, for example, the fear of hell is so powerful, having been instilled into children from early childhood, that as people approach death, they tend to become more fearful and actually less consoled by religion than you might think. So that's a subsidiary point. Religion may not actually be as consoling as you think. Many people are actually terrified of what's going to happen to them after they die because of the religion in which they've been brought up. Mm. But even if it is consoling, in those cases where it really is consoling, I come back to the more fundamental point that what is consoling doesn't make it true. And I would find it very hard to believe in something simply because it's consoling, unless there's some evidence that it's true. Mm. I think Steven Pinker put it rather well when he said, if you're being pursued by a tiger, you may console yourself by believing that it's a rabbit, but actually it's a tiger and it's going to eat you.
We have an email from a Christian who, in fact, quotes Pinker, or at least the argument that Pinker's making in The Better Angels of Our Nature, that violence is declining over time. And Christian writes, I'd love to hear Dr. Dawkins and others respond to this idea that less bad things are, in fact, happening these days than in the past.
This is a very encouraging book. I strongly recommend Steven Pinker. I recommend all Steven Pinker's books. But The Better Angels of Our Nature is a very scholarly, historical walk through human history, human prehistory and history, demonstrating with figures, with facts and figures, tables and graphs, that actually we are getting better. We're getting less violent, we're getting less unpleasant, we're getting nicer. It's not a smooth curve. I mean, there are horrible instances in the 20th century, for example. The two great world wars of the 20th century are among the most appalling things that's ever happened to humanity. But if you take the broad sweep of history, things are getting better. We're getting less violent, we're getting kinder, we're getting nicer. People no longer get entertainment from burning cats, no longer get entertainment from public executions, and so on. I do recommend the book. I think it's very plausible, and it's a very optimistic view, but it's a very well-informed view.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Nick, thanks very much for the call. Back to the phones. George is with us in Layton, Utah.
Hello, Doug, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I was wanting to comment on the idea that this seems to be based on the logic of the left brain. If you think about oneness with the right brain, you end up finding that there is a universe. And you can call that God if you like, but the word one verse or universe seems to be the thing that's important about it.
Dr. Dawkins, anything
about yes. I mean, this actually comes back to what we were talking about earlier when we were having the conversation about the confusion between various kinds of usage of the word God. Mm. If you want to use the word God to mean the universe,
right,
then that's fine. And we can talk and we can say, isn't the universe wonderful? And we can study it. And it's your choice to call it God. All I would ask of you is that you then admit that that's a very, very different usage of the word God from the one of a religious person, a theist, who believes that God came down to earth as Jesus and was crucified, and or Muhammad split the moon in half, went to the heaven on a winged horse. These sorts of things are so utterly, utterly different from the view of God that says, well, God is the entire universe, the sort of pantheistic view, that it just is confusing to use the same word, and people are confused by using the same word. So I can agree with you that the universe is wonderful and we can get a kind of quasi-religious feeling of awe about the universe. But for goodness sake, don't let other people hijack that sense of wonder by identifying it with a particular God who walked on water and changed water into wine, etc.
George, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, again, radiowest@kuer.org. Richard Dawkins is with us, the author of many books, including The God Delusion. His latest is a children's book called The Magic of Reality. We need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Richard Dawkins, the author of a number of books, a lot of books, among them The God Delusion, The Greatest Show on Earth. And we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radio west@KUER.org. Let's go back to the phones. Terry is with us in Tremont, in Utah. Terry, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Doug. I appreciate you taking my call. I have a question for your guest. I don't know if he's a parent or not, but we who are clearly feel that our children need to be exposed to some of the cruel things and the difficulties of life. It helps build character. It helps us grow, helps us learn to stand on our own two feet and develop. My question is, and one other point, as little children, we often see that as extremely cruel and unacceptable and unbelievable. My question to your guest is, why doesn't he think that a divine parent would be free to do the same thing?
Richard Dawkins?
And my point, to carry it a little further, I would suggest that your guest is also resembling more of a little child who cannot understand the wisdom of a divine parent that sees far beyond his ability to see the need for trial and opposition in all things.
I think the point you're making is that a divine parent, a God, would make us free to suffer and make us free to ask questions about suffering. And that's all very well if you've got any reason to think there's a divine parent at all. My whole point is that there is absolutely no reason whatsoever to think that there is a divine parent, that there is a God, and therefore the whole point you're making kind of rather disappears. I'm not concerned with the question of what the divine parent might or might not do. The onus is on you and other theists to provide the slightest fragment of evidence that there is a divine parent in the first place. Until you can do that, I'm going to live my life on the assumption that the picture of the universe that science portrays is the one we should be living by. It's been remarkably successful so far. It shows every sign of being successful into the future. And the message it has for us, for our living, is that we stand on our own two feet, courageously and bravely, and don't rely upon some figment of the imagination, a divine parent.
Terry, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Laura writes from West Valley City, Utah, "As an atheist, I do not view tragedy, such as mass murder, as an indication of evil or sin, but rather a failing of society. People," she writes, "are the products of their environment and their biology. They make choices based on the experiences of their lives." Dr. Dawkins, I guess you're with Laura on that.
I agree with every word of that.
Yeah.
Yes, nothing to say. Well put. Thank you.
I guess it gets to maybe a decent segue into the question that you or the issue rather that you bring up, which is that we need to get off of our knees, as you've put it, and face reality and let science do something constructive about human suffering. So what? I mean, I understand the idea of helping us understand a tsunami or an earthquake. Where does the act of a violence like an Adam Lanza, where does that come into? How does science help us understand that? Just understanding where they're coming from, mental illness, those kinds of things. What do you think?
Yes,
about that?
Mental illness. I mean, unfortunately, mental illness is a reality. It's not surprising that it's a reality. It's widespread in every country, and obviously science needs to do all it can to ameliorate mental illness. The people who are mentally ill suffer, and so medical science should be deployed to alleviate their suffering every bit as much as the suffering of physical illness. Mm-hmm. So what we can do from the point of view of practical politics would be to say to ourselves, given that there are certain kinds of mental illness which lead people to do acts of violence, can we do anything to stop them having the wherewithal to commit these acts of violence? And there's a very strong debate going on in the United States on gun control, and I'm not a citizen of this country, so I don't want to take a vigorous part in that debate, but it is worth noting that guns are far more freely available in this country than I think in any other Western civilized country. And violence perpetrated by guns is also hugely greater. it is worth giving some kind of consideration to whether, given that there are mad people around, people who are mentally ill in a violent way are around, should we try to make it harder for anybody to get weapons and therefore for those kinds of lunatics to get weapons?
Let's go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Michael is with us in Monroe, Utah. Michael, hi. Michael, you with us?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, in the past, Dr. Dawkins, you've drawn the distinction between atheism and agnosticism, and which I find fascinating in the whole idea of the teacup agnostic. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the difference between what it would mean to an atheist versus an agnostic, this question that you're talking about today.
Well, this is a philosophical question. Nobody can actually prove that there isn't a God. You can't prove a negative like that. You can make it seem extremely improbable. And one way to dramatize that improbability is to say that we're all agnostic. That means that we can't actually know. We're all agnostic about the existence of God, of gods, of any kind of God, in just the same way as we're agnostic about the existence of fairies and leprechauns and trolls and all the other hobgoblins and things. So you can't actually disprove the existence of fairies and pixies and hobgoblins and werewolves. But the onus is on somebody who wants to believe in fairies, or Thor, or Zeus, or Apollo, or Mithras. The onus is on people who want to believe it. And exactly the same is true of the Christian God, the Jewish God, the Muslim God. If you want to believe in any of those things, then come forward and give us the evidence. We are all technically agnostic because we cannot disprove the existence of either leprechauns or the tooth fairy or God, but we are de facto atheists until somebody produces some evidence for fairies or leprechauns or gods.
Michael, thanks. Back to the phones. David with us in Salt Lake. David, welcome. David?
Yes, this is David.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about the need for morality, or where morality comes from in the absence of a God. You talked about the scientific basis of truth, the wasp and the grub. The wasp acts totally amorally to preserve itself. But then you talked about the better angels of our nature. Where does morality come from? Why do we want to act good or bad? Why do we want to help or rather not hurt and not just act in our own best interest?
Yeah, okay. I mean, this is obviously a difficult question for everybody to face. And if you're a religious person who thinks you get your morality from religion, you should look very carefully at where it comes from. I don't think it comes from Scripture. I hope it doesn't come from Scripture, because if it did come from Scripture, we'd all be stoning people to death for breaking the Sabbath and things like that. So it doesn't come from Scripture. It clearly comes from somewhere else. Where does it come from? Well, wherever it is, and I can't answer that question, wherever it comes from, it's the same whether you're religious or not. And this is really the burden of Steven Pinker's book, that we are all getting more moral by a standard which is not written in the sky, it's not written in a holy book, but it's a standard that we all seem to agree about. In any particular century, there's a consensus as to what morality is. We all now agree that slavery is wrong. In spite of what the Bible says, slavery is wrong. We've moved on from biblical morality, we've abolished slavery, everybody agrees. If you ask, well, how do you know slavery is wrong? Where does it come from? Where does the belief that slavery is wrong come from? Well, you don't know, and I don't know, but clearly it comes from somewhere. If I had to hazard a guess, I would be rather a complicated guess. It comes from a consensus of discussion, of journalism, of court cases, of congressional parliamentary decisions, of dinner party conversations. The whole of society moves on steadily, decade by decade, towards a new kind of morality. We've given up slavery completely now. We're moving towards greater respect for women. We're moving towards better treatment of children, better treatment of non-human animals. These are progressive trends which everybody seems to agree upon, although some people are a bit ahead of the curve, other people are a bit behind the curve. It clearly doesn't come from religion, or it certainly doesn't come from Scripture. It's something in the air. It's something that affects all of us. I've called it the shifting moral zeitgeist. It seems to be real. It's documented in Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature, and it needs more study.
Let me ask you this finally. In 1998, in Unweaving the Rainbow, you lamented that at the end of the most scientifically successful of centuries, the 20th century, that science hadn't been more incorporated into our culture, and that our aesthetic sense hadn't, as you put it, risen to meet the poetry of science. More than 10 years on now, are you feeling better about all of that?
Pretty much the same, I think. I mean, I was inspired by Carl Sagan, who was always making that point. If you do appreciate science, if you do appreciate the grandeur of the universe, the sheer scale of it, the size of it, the length of time involved, the astonishing power of evolution by natural selection to produce not just bacteria, but colonies of bacteria, cells, living creatures, plants, animals, there's a beauty, there's an elegance, there's a grandeur in this view of life, as Darwin put it. It is a great aesthetic experience. It's comparable to the great experience of seeing a great cathedral, listening to a great piece of music, maybe in some respects even better. And people are missing so much if they go to their grave without ever having experienced all that science has to offer by way of telling us about the wonder of the universe and of life.
It's Richard Dawkins. His books include The God Delusion, most recently a children's book called The Magic of Reality. Joined us today from radio station KRCC in Colorado Springs. Dr. Dawkins, thanks very much for the time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.